This is WFAE Talks, our weekly newsroom podcast. I'm Greg Collard, news director of this fine public radio station. Education reporter Lisa Miller is here. Lisa, you're doing well this week?
I am doing well. Repticon is coming up this weekend.
What is?
Repticon.
Repticon. Okay, this is a conference for people who love reptiles.
Actually, can we start over? I'm sorry.
Why?
Can we start over?
No. That was great.
No. Tell us about Repticon, Lisa.
Yeah. We're not starting over.
All right. All right. I don't think I'm going to be able to go, but I met a teacher at a school. I was at Coolwood Middle School last week, and he had these, they're called degus. They're like Chilean rodents, and they were in the library. He said, hey, these are the perfect animals for a library. And I said, why? He said, well, their urine doesn't smell. And I said, oh, he said, yeah, they're diabetic. And then we talked a little while, and he told me about Repticon coming to Cabarrus County's convention center.
Fascinating.
So. Can I just jump in with two things? So for regular listeners of this podcast, number one, your bizarre fascination with South American animals continues.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot the...
And number two, we all now know that apparently... diabetic reptile urine does not stink.
Yes, yes.
Well, that voice you hear is money and influence reporter Tom Bullock, who's here being in place of Ben Bradford, who is being lazy today, taking the day off.
I don't think he's being lazy.
No, well-deserved day off. But Tom, are you sick of hearing about Julie Rose yet, the person you replaced?
Yeah, no, kinda, okay. But I will say... everybody in this town seems to have known Julie Rose. She's a hard act to follow.
Yes, she was. But you're doing an admirable job following up on her good work. So today's topics: former Mayor Patrick Cannon and the race to replace him. Political advertising. Tom had a story that showed how some U.S. Senate candidates are providing some assistance to third party interest groups. And a charter school in Charlotte closes in less than a year. But only after getting more than $2 million in public money to start off the school year. So first up, the Patrick Cannon saga. Really no update in the case this week. We're just kind of waiting for see if another shoe's going to drop.
And which at this point you almost wonder how many feet there are because there's been so many shoes that have been dropping as we go along. No update. We're still waiting to see if Patrick Cannon is indicted. We thought it may come this week, but we have to wait for the grand jury to move on that. And we'll find out here. Obviously, we're taping on Friday. We'll find out on Monday when the 11 members of the city council sit down and actually they're expected to. They've said that they will, but of course, things can change. Tell us who the next mayor of Charlotte's going to be.
Well, meanwhile, Patrick Cannon was the subject of some ridicule this week on The Daily Show. Let's go ahead and hear that tape.
Yes, I was elected mayor, but the end game has always been to become the douche king of North Carolina. I am the douche king.
Of course, that is a reference to the
hers.
in the criminal complaint that he had a feminine hygiene product company that he wanted the FBI agent who was
posing as a real estate
developer to invest in. We still don't know if hers was a company he really wanted to start up or if it was just something he made up to.
According to the complaint, he had a rudimentary PowerPoint presentation on this that he emailed to the developers.
The spreadsheet, which we assume
and
would be,
the spreadsheets.
You know, it's a growth industry. Who knows?
For sure. And what was it? Maybe $1,000 wired to some company in Taiwan.
Right. Labeled R&D. We don't know for sure if it has to do with hers, but that's clearly, or you know, if it was just a front. But I have to say, when I found out about hers, it was because Ben Bradford, who of course is normally here, he called me as he was reading the complaint. I was going down to City Hall, and he's like, you know, this happened, and then dig around and see if you can find anything about hers, this feminine hygiene product that Patrick Cannon was involved in. I was like,
he just says it straight face, like, of course, that's just.
And I had literally like, what? Are you hazing the new guy, Ben? Like, what? I'm glad that, I mean, first of all, I think every journalist wants to be Jon Stewart when they grow up. I'm glad he brought it up because it is It is so bizarre, and yet it's right there in a legal document. I just can't believe that.
It's just bizarre. Okay, well, let's go on to the next topic. Story you had, concerning political advertising, Tom. Some third-party interest groups are getting a pretty big assist from couple of U.S. Senate candidates, Kay Hagan and Tom Tillis.
It's huge, and it's called B-roll footage. And what it is, and again, you can find it all on our website. It is these are collections of the most generic political shots that you can imagine. Everybody's always smiling around the candidate. They're always nodding in agreement. They're shaking hands. It is like if you were going to have an 8-year-old put together a political ad, these were the kinds of shots that they would use. It's just the obvious stuff. And the reason it gets a little interesting is because having these B-roll footage posted on public sites, which these candidates are doing, allows outside groups, third party, you know, be it Democrat or Republican or independent, to take footage of the candidate that they're supporting and insert it into their ad. So it blurs this line between what is a candidate ad, what is a third party ad. It's also potentially illegal because there's not supposed to be any coordination between the campaigns, and some are questioning openly whether producing B-roll, hoping that it gets used by these third-party candidate or third-party groups, these outside groups, is actually against the law.
They're making it available so that third-party groups can use it. I mean, anyone else can too. Mm-hmm. And the third part, one of these groups that you talked to, they admitted that's how they got it, and they see no problem with that.
Absolutely.
And they seem to appreciate that being made available to them by Kay Hagan, I think, and that was
in that case. It was Kay Hagan. Yeah, the group was the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And I, you know, when I called up the president to talk to him, I was expecting
– The president of this group.
The president of this group. Yes, I did not call Barack Obama to see exactly what he thought. Okay. I was expecting some kind of a song and dance about it. And he was like absolutely fine telling me, we absolutely – you know, we downloaded this video at Kay Hagan's campaign, paid for the shoot. It's professionally staged. They put it together. We just downloaded it and used it in our ad. He did not try to dance around it at all.
So one interesting thing then, you look at these third-party interests – group ads, and it looks like a campaign ad. It looks more like a candidate ad with there's so much footage of them in there. It's really hard to tell the difference. I mean, you just see before we got used to, we knew what the third party groups were right off the bat, but it's a little bit harder to tell now.
Yeah. In fact, about the only way that you can do it is if you have to really pay attention and look for the paid for written at the tiny little letters at the bottom of the ad, or, you know, if it's a candidate ad, it still has to have the, you know, I'm Tom Bullock and I approve this message somewhere in there.
And I thought, I mean, it was fascinating when you brought the FEC into this and their ruling as far as being completely divided on this, which means it's kind of in this complete gray area. I mean, something could change. And your interview with the FEC representative, right?
Head of the FEC.
Former head of the FEC. Was fascinating as far as whether this is proper or not.
Yeah, I found it really interesting. I mean, first of all, I can't imagine with something that's so as contentious as campaign finance that the rule would be you could have a panel that could tie. You would think instead of 6 members, you would have 7. So that way they would always come up with a rule like, I don't know, the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. But they have 6 members and a tie just means no decision. And it's really allowing these groups to push boundaries in ways that they never have before, because there's a pretty good chance that no one's ever going to rule on it, which means it doesn't mean that it's legal. It just means they're not going to get busted.
Mm-hmm. Well, any indication about whether other candidates are going to be doing this? I'm sure this is a growth industry.
Yeah, and you know, let's go back to John Stewart, who you played earlier. I mean, the way a lot of people found out about it was because he had this whole thing about McConnelling, which is in reference to Mitch McConnell. Who actually, John Stewart just noticed his website. It's growing nationally. More and more people are doing it. In my research for this story, I also found evidence that there's this stuff called opposition research, which is when a candidate, you know, compiles everything negative or everything they can use in an ad about an opponent. They're posting that online now too. They're posting anything that they can think of just publicly, just hoping that these outside groups with huge pockets and a lot of times untraceable donors, you know, they can find what the candidate or, you know, the campaign they're supporting, what they've posted online and decide to make their own ads.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's going to be an interesting year, especially as the general comes along, too. So on to the next topic. Charter school, Student First Academy, charter school in Charlotte closes in less than a year after getting more than $2 million in public money to start off the year. Lisa, you covered this story. It's been in the news a lot. And this
And Helms at the Charlotte Observer has been doing a lot of good looking into at this school. But yeah, it was a private school that opened in 2001, and its enrollment really started to decline in the last few years. But it converted to a charter school. So what that means is that no longer was it depending on tuition to pay the bills. It was depending on public money, which didn't pay the bills. You know, there's a lot of trying to figure out what happened.
There's $600,000 in debt already.
Exactly. And so how it works with the state is the state basically makes one upfront payment at the beginning of the year to a charter school. And most of the money comes from the state. So they gave the charter school about $1.6 million in the beginning of school. Now, the school was expecting to have something like 430 students. They staffed the school for 430 students. They opened up with about 330 students. And, you know, part of that was, you know, they had to start laying off staff by December. And then there was just all of this undocumented spending that the charter board called in, you know, outside auditors. And they're saying, you know, buses aren't running on time. Kids don't have textbooks. And thousands of dollars aren't accounted for. So, you know, the Office of Charter Schools, which monitors charters, there's I think four or six of these folks at the office, and they're in charge of 130-something charter schools right now. They've paid the school a visit and do interviews and all that. So the board, charter school board, has to start meeting with the state, and basically they have 30 days to figure out how they're going to pay this money back and get everything on course. You know, the former administrators are fired. There's a lawsuit involving that. So it's just this sort of incredible situation that snowballs. They got a new principal in January, but you know, when you're coming up with that amount of debt so early on and all these problems, it's really hard to pull that school out of that situation.
Well, and I love the fact that they had no textbooks. I mean, if they get the money up front, what was it, $1.2 million?
$1.6 million
from the state, you would think at the beginning of the school year that, I don't know, they'd buy some textbooks. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of startup expenses involved with a charter school. But yeah, it seems like there were some pretty basic things that went.
How did the school get approved? I mean, if it's just.
Yeah, seriously.
I mean, it's. How?
Sure. So, I mean, actually, the people in charge of the school, and this is through Anne's reporting at the Observer, her articles were saying, you know, people who were good with charter schools, who are in the know, they thought, oh, these people know what they're doing. They've had the school for a while. They had on the board a UNC education professor,
UNC Charlotte,
education professor specializing in urban education. So there was a lot of respect, but then, you know, shortly when things were starting to come together, Anne quoted the head of Sugar Creek Charter School, which is a very successful charter school here in Charlotte, and she was talking to the administrator of that school and was getting questions like, hey, could you guys come over and set up our I think it was a lunch program, and she's like, this is stuff that you're responsible for. And, you know, people started having doubts really quickly on in that process after that was approved.
Shouldn't those questions be addressed when you're trying to get approval, though? I mean, that's a pretty basic thing.
I asked Joel Medley. He oversees.
Well, if you provide lunch. A lot of these don't provide lunch.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And, you know, I asked Joel Medley. He oversees charter schools for this state. You know, hey, are you confident that this screening process was good enough? And what he basically said was, you know, let me answer it this way. We have a new board in place who goes through all these applications, and they are being very thorough, and they've raised the bar. I said, well, you know, what do you mean raise the bar? How so? He says, well, we get the same amount of applications this year, and, you know, fewer are being let in for interviews. So,
What have you? You've I know followed some of their meetings. What has your impression been? Do they seem to ask good questions?
Yeah, they do. They do ask good questions. I mean, you have all of these applications. I mean, I can't remember this year how many, but dozens and dozens of applications coming through, and then they get called back for interviews if they think it's a strong application, and then they do really go through these applications and they ask them tough questions. In some ways, it's kind of like when you have a flux, you know, you have all these applications, it's difficult. But I mean, it's a board that meets once a month, you know, maybe 2 days a month or something like that. So they certainly do have to make their way through that process.
Is there any indication about the quality of education these students were receiving, or any of whether it was good or bad? Or
Well, so at this point, I haven't seen any test scores, because I mean, the big test scores that we would see would be taken at the end of the year, and these kids never got to the end of the year. They will be taking those tests at, you know, most of them going to CMS schools around there. Mm-hmm.
So,
and now meanwhile, point out that now CMS will not be compensated for the money it had to fork over for these students. They will not be compensated at all for taking them back in.
Mm-mm.
For this year.
No, they'll receive a little bit of county money for the last 2 months, but the bulk of the money, the state, you know, I was talking to people at the state and they said, hey, you know, we gave them $1.6 million and, you know, we'd be, if we gave more to the district, we'd essentially be double paying for education. So.
Yeah, I was just going to ask what happens to the students that were there. I mean, I know this happened like pretty quickly. I mean,
very quickly. Yeah. But what's interesting is, so they started off the year with about 340 students. And then in January started hearing more things, you know, I'm sure those parents could have seen what was going on, you know, late buses, no textbooks, things like that. But then there are articles about this. And what I know is that it started at 330. Right now, there are about 260 kids that I think are there. So kids were kind of leaving there as people saw what was going on. But yeah, you have 260 kids who now will have to be accommodated, most of them, I'm sure, in CMS schools. I mean, really, CMS says that, you know, they're from all over the county. So it may be a school taking one or two or three of them. But, you know, there will be probably a couple schools, and they could be close to where that charter is in West Charlotte. I'm not sure, but they're accommodating maybe 20 kids or so.
And do we have any idea if, I mean, they have to switch schools so late in the year. Are their lesson plans going to line up? Are their credits going to be at risk? I mean,
are schools going to be held accountable if their test scores are low?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and those are things that, I don't know. You know, they should be. It's very tough to transition mid-year as a student. If you're a teacher teaching these kids, it's a difficult transition. But when you only have 2 months of school, I mean, that is tough.
All right. We will, I'm sure, hope and get some answers in the next few weeks on that story. So, Lisa, Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right.